Chapter 2. Us Two Against the World. Not gay as in happy, queer as in fuck your borders. Lesbians and gays support the migrants. Why two? I don't understand the two. I think we should ask the question. Judith Butler. Less than a year before his affair with advisor Gina Colodangelo was exposed by the Sun newspaper, former UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock failed to define an established relationship live on television. The government's COVID-19 rules at the time allowed sex only in a relationship defined as such, which amounted, so Hancock's Sky News interviewer Kay Burley suggested, to a casual sex ban. Burley had two questions. When can people fuck freely, and what is an established relationship anyway? Hancock could answer neither, but his flustered, labyrinthine responses were TV gold, and the dynamic between him and Burley made it seem like the sublimated question might be, when can we fuck? Why am I whispering? I don't know, giggled Burley. I don't know, you're live on national TV, Kay, Hancock bantered. Burley teased him. It's okay to smile. The viral clip of their exchange, in which they attempt to delineate casual sex from an established relationship, is both a chronicle of governmental futility and circularity and a study in heteronormativity. As if cosplaying a beleaguered girlfriend, Burley asks stump boyfriend Hancock what an established relationship means to him. The two awkwardly agree that he is in such a relationship with Mrs. Hancock. I want you, a text message to a COVID-era lover might have read. I'm not sure we should, would read the disappointed reply. I just don't think we're there yet. I mean, in a Mr. and Mrs. Hancock relationship. Seeking specifics, Burley ventures whether established might mean saying I love you, but some people say that and they don't mean it, or going out for dinner, twice, or knowing each other for 6 months. By those and many other standards, Hancock and Colodangelo's relationship, as well as his marriage, was surely established. Yet CCTV footage of the pair's snatch snog and arse squeezing prompted national fascinated scandal. Rather than on account of his deadly mismanagement of the pandemic, Hancock resigned immediately after the affair became public. Forsaking all others. Marriage rates in the UK for straight couples have never been lower, and divorce rates continue to rise. But the institution and its ostensible framework, monogamy, are still held dear in society. Infractions of this framework are generally seen as moral failings. Certainly, cheating, breaking an agreement of exclusivity in a relationship, involves betrayal and dishonesty. It can be traumatic and damage relationships. At the same time, the gravity ascribed to cheating compared to other determinants affecting the health of a relationship, such as open communication, emotional safety, mutual care and autonomy, is worth examining. Despite Hancock's wife being a wealthy conservative who had benefited from people's suffering under the cruel government policies imposed by the man she chose to marry, when she was cheated on, her political affiliations suddenly mattered little even to some committed leftists. Sex, as the root of virtue, has long been a special case in our culture, wrote Susan Sontag, evoking peculiarly inconsistent attitudes. People of all political affiliations expressed compassion for Hancock's scorned wife and lauded her for behaving with dignity. It is likely that Martha and Matt had not, in fact, agreed upon a non-monogamous marriage. The fact that we can be fairly sure about this speaks volumes to the enduring dominance of compulsory monogamy, in which monogamy is not only assumed, but considered natural and right, and encouraged by societal forces, from pop songs to state policies promoting and rewarding marriage. After Hancock's shambolic television interview, a survey of British people showed that 70% of respondents believed that being in an established relationship meant being exclusive, so neither of Hancock's relationships was established in that case. Because of this compulsory aspect, attempting to work out what we really want in relation to monogamy can be confusing. As a desire, it has been muddied by social pressure to comply and by institutionalisation. Heterosexuality, or alignment with its mores, is also compulsory in this way. Adrienne Rich's concept of compulsory heterosexuality, or comp-het, explains how institutionalised heterosexuality is characterised by the absence of choice because of the psychological, cultural and material pressures that back it up, whilst delegitimizing and erasing lesbian experience. Meanwhile, consensually non-monogamous relationships are often delegitimized as, at best, kooky, slutty alternatives to real love, or else as loveless, commitment-phobic aberrations threatening the sanctity of the couple form. Public sex scandals might be less salacious if compulsory monogamy, like any dominant and institutionalized framework for sexuality, didn't predetermine relationships. If heterosexuality and monogamy are always already assumed and assumed optimal, it can be difficult to do things differently, or even to imagine how they might be different, or admit we might want them to be. A well-known sexuality scholar once told me she was thinking of writing a book about how the prevalence of cheating can in part be explained by the barriers to expressing non-normative desires, but was scared off doing so by the fact she might be ostracized for defending cheaters with the moral weight this carries. With the protection of anonymity, however, in 2000, the decentralized anarchist collective Crime Think published Adultery and Other Half Revolutions. The polemic considers whether, in a society where romantic love equals monogamy, desire is organized contractually and anything else is considered bad ethics, adultery could be understood as half a revolution. The authors do not think cheating is good, or that it amounts to resistance against prevailing sexual mores. Instead, they describe it as the worst half of the revolution, lacking in courage and analysis. They propose that, rather than betraying and deceiving a lover, owning outlawed desires and taking responsibility for the pain that might cause might go some way to resisting the circle of hurt that is the scarcity economy of love. Is love a scarcity economy? In many ways, it isn't. People can and do proclaim to love multiple people, children, friends, family members. Only when it comes to romantic love do we contend with the truth claim that love is a zero-sum game. Our current notion of romantic love has a short history. It was only in the 17th and 18th centuries that the idea of romantic love as the primary reason for marriage was explored among the wealthy in the West. Romantic love, as defined by sexual passion and intimate compassion, was at this time a mostly extramarital affair. It was not until the 19th century that love marriages were more widely accepted, and even then, marriage was ultimately a transaction, a matter of securing power within social groups by consolidating status, wealth, and land, and preserving them in the hands of heirs. Women were thus traded on the marriage market as assets, mostly having little, if any, say in who they married. Not so much has changed with regard to marriage as we might like to think. People still largely marry within their own race, religion, and social class, influenced by family opinions. Most marriages retain elements of patriarchal ceremony, in a man asking a father for permission to take his daughter's hand, for example, or in a woman being given away. Research shows that whilst men married to women tend to be healthier and live longer, women married to men tend to die younger. Whilst marriage or other commitment rituals need not be this way, it is important, as bell hooks argues, to have a sharp, ongoing critique of marriage in a patriarchal society, because once you marry within a society that remains patriarchal, no matter how alternative you want to be within your unit, there is still a culture outside you that will impose many, many values on you, whether you want them to or not. In The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State, Friedrich Engels explores the history of the bourgeois monogamous family as a way of organizing society, explaining its purpose to optimize private wealth accumulation and patrilineal property inheritance. The monogamous family, as Engels construes it, was, since its inception, a unit to privatize care, transmit property, and maximize consumption. A similar analysis has been applied to coupledom. The logic of the couple, argue Clements ex Clementine and associates from the Infinite Venom Girl Gang, is that which funnels, simplifies, and reduces amorous desire to the needs of patriarchy within the capitalist mode of production. With people relating primarily in twos, populations are also probably easier to control and less likely to build power against the state than would be the case if making more expansive intimate commitments were the norm. By the mid-19th century, monogamous marriage and the nuclear family were considered working-class aspirations, rather than solely the reserve of the rich. Those who adopted these forms, as the writer M.E. O'Brien argues, could access the narrow respectability of legal marriage by differentiating themselves from the sex working and queer deviants of their class. In civilizing missions, colonizer nations sought to supplant existing indigenous forms of kinship, as well as less binary ways of doing gender and sexuality, with the respectable form. This settler sexuality, a heteropatriarchal and sexual modernity exemplary of white settler civilization, as the gender studies professor Scott L. Morganson puts it, was violently imposed on colonized peoples because it furthered imperial capitalist ends. Anti-sodomy laws were introduced by colonial penal codes, and indigenous peoples were often coerced into Christian marriage. As scholar and artist Liam Bedesomasake Simpson writes, "Since Michisagi-Anishinaabeg nationhood is at its core relational, and all our political practices stem from the establishment and maintenance of good relations, indigenous intimate partnerships were diverse and shattered the heteronormative sexual and relationship orientations of settlers. There were practices of non-monogamy, separation, divorce, and situations where both genders had more than one partner. These unchurched relationships were the subject of much settler surveillance." The colonial imposition of settler sexuality was not total. In a 1978 essay on Black Woman and Love, Audre Lorde writes that the Fon of Dahomey on the west coast of Africa still have 12 different kinds of marriage, including where a woman of independent means marries another woman, who then may or may not bear children, all of whom will belong to the bloodline of the first woman. "This accepted kind of marriage," she says, "is arranged to provide heirs for women of means who wish to remain free, and some are lesbian relationships." With reference to colonization in North America, where indigenous peoples traditionally practiced more expansive forms of kinship, such as extended kin groups, including plural marriage, indigenous scholar Kim Toolbear explains how and why settler forms were enforced. "If Indians could not all be killed outright, then the savages might also be eliminated by forced conversions to whiteness. Both the church and the state evangelized marriage, nuclear family, and monogamy. These standards were simultaneously lauded over indigenous peoples as an aspirational model and used to justify curtailing their biological reproduction and stealing their children. So marriage was yoked together with private property in settler coercions of indigenous peoples. The breakup of indigenous peoples' collectively held lands into privately held allotments controlled by men as heads of household enabled the transfer of surplus lands to the state and to mostly European or Euro-American settlers. Racist disciplining of romantic and sexual intimacies also impacted former slaves in the United States. As outlined by O'Brien, Black proletarians during Reconstruction seized on their freedom in forming new families and sexual relationships, drawing on the diversity of romantic codes forged under slavery. In government records gathered about Black families after the American Civil War, historians find a diversity of relationship and family structures greater than their white contemporaries on farms or in factories. Many Black couples during Reconstruction took up in sweetheart or trial marriages, or were living together in non-marital, temporary, and often non-monogamous romantic relationships. Couples could co-parent in such temporary arrangements, raising sweetheart children. Where colonial and antebellum laws banned marriage between slaves, legal marriage was mandated for Black couples after the Civil War, and soon, O'Brien notes, Black people were being investigated and prosecuted for violating marital laws, prohibiting fornication and adultery. Throughout history, laws regulating intimate relationships, especially marriage laws, have been about nation building, whether by promoting white population growth over Black, for example, in prohibitions of Black and interracial marriage, or by bringing previously excluded groups into the state-sanctioned kinship forms of marriage and the nuclear family, for example, in legalizing gay marriage. The way the state and social norms construct sexuality is conceptualized by Christopher Chitty in his book on Statecraft, Sodomy, and Capital in the Rise of the World System, as sexual hegemony, where the sexual norms as aspirational fantasy or a form of social status of a dominant group are naturalized to the extent that they shape the sexual behavior and self-understanding of other groups. Sexual hegemony, argues Chitty, operates in inconsistent ways over time, is variably achieved by force and consent, repression and persuasion, and is a critical tool for the accumulation of capital and the consolidation of bourgeois rule. Are you on the market? Most people don't think about their love lives in terms of capitalism, but how we practice and speak about such relationships is revealing. If we do not have a partner, we are on the market, perhaps hot property, or if we are an older woman, on the shelf. Dating is competitive and involves investments. People's worth and value to us is weighed up as we shop around. The logic of capitalism is rife in normative approaches to what might be among our most intimate relationships. People are increasingly meeting romantic prospects using online platforms or dating products, owned by tech corporations such as Match Group, whose tagline promises global presence, revolutionary technology, deeper connections. Match Group owns nearly every major US dating site, including Hinge, OkCupid, and Tinder, the latter of which generated $1.4 billion in revenue in 2020, up from $47 million in 2015. Dating apps require self-commodification to optimize your assets in competition with others. And whilst the internet can make dating more accessible for those who face more barriers to meeting people in person, discrimination rooted in oppressive systems play out on the platforms. In quickfire, anonymous swiping, perhaps it is even amplified. People who are racialized, trans, disabled, or fat report facing repeated rejection or fetishization on dating apps. The apps themselves can facilitate this. Multiple dating sites allow users to filter based on ethnicity, for example. And although the attendant bias is usually only said to reflect societal racism, this argument, as lecturer in digital media, culture and technology Alfie Bone notes, circumvents the possibility that the app's own algorithms might be at least partially responsible for not only proliferating but rewriting sectarian trends in relationship building. Apps are just one element of the dating industrial complex. For men who feel they need intensive rebranding to be attractive romantic candidates for women, the industry offers a costly solution: pickup artistry. Pickup artist, or PUA coaching, goes far beyond sharing flirting tips between friends. A day-long impactful connection workshop in London, led by PUA Johnny Cassell, costs £750 and includes training on how to create solid, high-value social circles from scratch and leverage them for dating success, as well as fostering nightlife dominance to pick up dancers and models. From 9 p.m. till midnight, course attendees access The Real Learning, a night out harassing women. On Johnny Cassell's website, there is a chat box. I ask the interface if there is any proof that the course will increase my chances of sleeping with beautiful women, and I'm told to look at the course's feedback, testifying to its success rate for men seeking a higher caliber of woman. The person messaging asks me if I have other goals. I want a good wife, I respond, not a feminist who refuses her duties. I certainly think we can help you, he types. Cassell's course is subtler than some. Another PUA course, that of Nick Krauser, advertises access to younger, hotter, tighter women through a 5-day course costing £5,000. Krauser's FAQ page answers yes to, "Are you racist, sexist, homophobic?" Men fawn in the comments of his YouTube channel, "When I grow up, I want to be just like you." Cassell's and Krauser's ideas about dating form part of the manosphere, an online misogynist, alt-right adjacent community of mostly white men where radicalization can manifest in anti-feminist terrorism. Among this community are incels, or involuntary celibates, who pontificate in forums about why women won't have sex with them and develop theories about the dominant sexual order in which only some people can be sexually successful. Increasingly, incels are murdering women over this perceived injustice. In August 2021, Jake Davison, a 22-year-old white man from Plymouth who was active in the manosphere, killed 5 people in Britain's most deadly mass shooting in more than a decade. The ideology that inspired this massacre is arguably an extremist version of that which guides heteronormative dating and sexual relations under capitalism. If romantic intimacy and sex are something to be won, and women are rendered property, commodified with varying degrees of value, then, According to this schema, some men are going to be losers. In this worldview, as the writer Rebecca Solnit argues, for men, sex with high-value women can be a matter of primitive accumulation and status. Being unable to accrue such status might lead to internalized disappointment or depression, or it might result in men violating or killing women who they see as the objects of their unfulfilled entitlement. The tragic irony of incel philosophy, as the philosopher Amir Srinivasan points out, is that the sexual order in which these men experience themselves as undesirable is the same culture of discrimination and objectification they are reiterating by demanding their right to sex with only fuckable, young, conventionally attractive, white, non-disabled, cis women. Romance, sex, and the state. The belief held by incels that their lives are futile without romantic relationships and sex is supported by the state's interventions in this arena. At school, children are taught both implicitly and explicitly the right and proper behaviours in this realm. The dominant messaging, straight is good, marriage is the best. Indeed, mainstream sex education is not free from the legacy of Thatcher's Section 28, which banned schools and local authorities from promoting the teaching of the acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. The law was only revoked in 2000 in Scotland and in 2003 in the rest of the UK. The latest UK relationships and sex education guidance places emphasis on marriage as a primary, lifelong commitment between two people, without including content about alternative forms. The prevailing state agenda with regards to sex education is much more about upholding patriarchal morality than consent and pleasure. Marriage is a privileged form of relationship, entailing social status as well as material benefits. The institution is commonly endorsed by religious leaders and politicians as the bedrock of our society, ostensibly meaning a moral foundation, but also accurately describing the nuclear family's role for capitalism. The bedrock of our society accolade has been invoked by conservatives when legalizing same-sex marriage and when launching tax policies that incentivize marriage. Offering married couples tax breaks, said Prime Minister David Cameron in 2015, is about valuing commitment, because it's families who raise our children, look after our old, and keep our country going. Today, the marriage allowance, which is only available to cohabiting couples who are married or in a civil partnership, reduces tax by around £250 a year. Stigma around separation and divorce, especially without grave incompatibility or betrayal, persists. When Hancock's affair surfaced, the Evening Standard magazine ran an editorial warning of the perils of leaving your spouse. The public infidelity should provide women with a lightning rod, it reads, suggesting they might clutch their messy, irritating husbands tighter. Because unless your partner is an abuser, a relationship is a relationship is a relationship, and swapping a dull one for a shiny new one can be a naive mistake. Whilst this statement is certainly not untrue, an enduring partnership must surely withstand boredom, the underlying assumption seems to be that mature love always means monogamy, and that a compare-the-market type approach can be mapped onto love and desire. The promotion of marriage is entwined with reactionary politics. In 2018, the Conservative MP Derek Thomas proposed a parliamentary debate entitled Marriage and Government Policy. Thomas, a former property developer and a supporter of evangelical Christian doctrines, scheduled the debate ahead of Marriage Week. Marriage Week is organised by the Marriage Foundation, which was set up by the High Court family judge Paul Coleridge, who has compared single parents to cancerous cells in society, and has links to the Christian right group Christian Concern, which is homophobic and anti-abortion. The Marriage Foundation, employing a common tactic of Christian right organisations in the United States, underpins its pro-marriage campaigning with unsubstantiated evidence of its quantifiable superiority as a way of life for the good of society, especially our children. The belief that monogamous marriage and the nuclear family are superior ways of life is not supported by any meaningful evidence, yet the idea has been backed by successive governments. Finding somewhere to live is generally made easier for couples and families. When registering for social housing, for example, couples who are married or in civil partnerships are prioritised for joint tenancies. We will not agree to an existing tenant having a joint tenancy with anyone other than a husband, wife, registered civil partner or partner, states one local authority website. It is easier to rent a property as a nuclear family of five than as a group of five people who considered themselves family, because the law would not consider them one household, but a house share. Adverts often explicitly state, no sharers, families only. In a particularly stark example of regulating intimacy, this year the city of Shawnee in Kansas in the United States banned co-living, meaning four or more unrelated people renting a home altogether. And whilst home ownership is increasingly out of reach for a large section of society, two incomes can help, and buying as a couple, especially a married couple, entails more legal and financial protections. Buying a house as a group or as part of a cooperative structure is made very complicated by the law and banks. When assessing people for benefits, the state assumes that someone with a partner who has more money or resources can depend upon them for material support. Where someone is deemed to have a partner and the couple is deemed eligible for benefits, those payments go into one person's account. This results in people being denied the state support they require and traps them in relationships they may want to leave or need to leave for their own safety. For its own ends, the state seeks to categorize human relationships, even though their forms are infinite. When a friend of mine tried to claim housing benefit whilst living with her close friend, she had to convince the government that he was not, in fact, her partner, which would have disqualified her from state support. What determines this, as Matt Hancock and Kay Burley grappled with, is anyone's guess. Interrogating my friend on the status of her domestic relationship, the interviewer asked whether the man she lived with made her tea and where they sat when they got home from work. Monogamy is a given in the state-sanctioned ideal of romantic relationships, despite the fact it was only from around the 19th century that monogamy became an expectation, at least of men as well as women. A 2018 House of Commons briefing paper on polygamy states, in order to be recognised as legally valid, all marriages which take place in the United Kingdom must be monogamous. In theory, this means that legal marriage in the UK must be between two people, but the literal implications of the statement raise more questions. Monogamy is more commonly understood as sexual exclusivity between two people. According to this understanding, would every marriage that has involved cheating and every marriage that is consensually non-monogamous be legally invalid? Meanwhile, until 1991, rape within marriage was not a criminal offence, a wedding apparently signifying ongoing consent to sex for life. A 1992 report for Parliament by the Law Commission paints a troubling picture of marriage. Most of the Criminal Law Revision Committee at the time did not consider non-consensual intercourse within marriage to be as grave an offence as non-consensual intercourse outside marriage. The report also debated the impact of criminalising marital rape on the party's marriage and the institution of marriage. Adultery, on the other hand, in the UK and elsewhere, has long been considered an offence, even a crime, worthy of violent punishment, especially for women, though also for men who have sex with other men's wives. As the psychotherapist Esther Perel notes, adultery is the only commandment that is repeated twice in the Bible, once for doing it and once for just thinking about it. In 1707, English Lord Chief Justice John Holt pronounced that a man having sex with someone else's wife was the highest invasion of property, and that a man cannot receive a higher provocation. In many ways, prevailing sentiments haven't changed all that much today. Whilst cheating isn't illegal in the UK today, it is for the most part considered unequivocally wrong in heterosexual relationships, often with different implications for men versus women. Infidelity is often invoked in legal proceedings as a justification for violent crimes of passion, usually of men defending their honour, and sometimes still results in lenient sentences or even exoneration. Provocation as a mitigating legal defence for murder, which included a husband discovering his wife in the act of adultery, was only repealed in 2010, and it is still possible for judges to interpret defences related to infidelity from the succeeding defence, renamed loss of control. In 2012, the UK's most senior judge ruled that juries should be allowed to consider adultery as provocation for murder, leading to John Jack Clinton, who killed his wife in their home, having his murder conviction quashed. He was later convicted in a retrial. Until April 2022, married people had to make accusations against each other in order to be granted a divorce. Before no-fault divorce became legal at this time, Adultery was the first reason listed on the UK government's website as grounds for divorce. Committing adultery, it specified, means your husband or wife had sexual intercourse with someone else of the opposite sex. A spouse having sex with someone who is not of the opposite sex was not then considered cheating by the courts. Because heterosexist society does not consider queer sex real sex? Because queer people are characterised as sexually promiscuous? Yes, but also because divorce law had not been updated since 1973, when gay sex between men was barely legal. But whilst adultery might not exist for same-sex couples in UK law, marriage does. The fight for marriage equality was finally won in 2014 in Britain and in 2020 in Northern Ireland. Whilst the extension of the right to marry was widely celebrated, the issue was more contentious within the gay and queer liberation movement. To some, focusing on the right to marry was a concession to assimilation into ritualised, institutionalised, normal and therefore supposedly moral, heterosexual life. This trajectory, argues Michael Warner in his book The Trouble with Normal, not only distracts from more urgent arenas of oppression, such as the poverty and violence queer people face, but shores up the dominant heteropatriarchal order in which many lives and relationships that cannot or will not be subsumed into a normative framework will always be marginalised, disposable, and stigmatised as immoral. On this issue, Warner quotes the conservative writer and activist Jonathan Rauch, who has advocated for same-sex marriage. Rauch argues in favour of gay marriage as a means of solidifying the privileged status of marriage in society, writing that it must be understood to be better, on average, than other ways of living. If gay marriage is recognised, single gay people over a certain age should not be surprised when they are disapproved of or pitied. That is a vital part of what makes marriage work. Its stigma as social policy. As Prime Minister David Cameron said in 2011, I don't support gay marriage despite being a conservative. I support gay marriage because I'm a conservative. Support for gay rights has been cast in homo-nationalist terms, in which Western society is depicted as progressive, while migrants and racialised people, especially Muslims, are deemed exceptionally homophobic. This ahistorical position, ignoring the history of colonisation in which Western countries imposed anti-queer laws in the global South, is then used to justify anti-migrant and racist opinions on policies, including military intervention. Gay marriage, constructed as a kind of love marriage par excellence, argues Sita Balani in her article What's Love Got to Do with It? Marriage and the Security State, has become a means by which the nation-state, and specifically the UK, maintains a moral economy in which the normative discourse of romantic love can be held up against bad immigrants and their arranged marriages. Under the guise of a concern for women's welfare, freedom, and the self-actualising status of romantic love, values that are attractive in the liberal imaginary, she argues the wrong kind of marriage is used as a straw man to justify racist borders. This narrative is employed in attempts to stop sham marriages, that is, marriages with the purpose of obtaining a visa. The state adjudicates on relationships and sexuality by subjecting migrants to intrusive, offensive, and absurd interrogations by the Home Office, designed to reveal that their claim to real love and/or queerness is a sham. The idea that visa marriages are illegitimate rests on the idea that real marriages are always motivated by a specific, organic, and universal experience of romantic love, which of course is not the case, nor was it assumed to be the case in even recent history. The state's arbitration on our romantic and sexual lives is backed up by a cultural, ideological system that deems some kinds of people and relationships good, normal and natural, indeed more real, and others bad, abnormal and unnatural. In her 1984 essay Thinking Sex, Gail Rubin conceptualised this sexual stratification as a way in which society displaces social anxieties, especially during times of intense crisis, often through appeals, like that of the Marriage Foundation, to protect children from imagined threats. Good sex, according to Rubin's charmed circle diagram, is heterosexual, monogamous, marital, reproductive, intergenerational, and non-commercial. It happens at home, without porn, sadomasochism, or sex toys. In the hierarchy of good to bad sex, she observes, Individuals whose behaviour stands high are rewarded with certified mental health, respectability, legality, social and physical mobility, institutional support, and material benefits, whilst those who fall lower on the scale are subjected to a presumption of mental illness, disreputability, criminality, restricted social and physical mobility, loss of institutional support, and economic sanctions. The idea that a monogamous marriage or romantic partnership is more valuable than other kinds of relationships, sometimes called couple privilege, was reinforced during the COVID pandemic and successive lockdowns. If you were involved in this kind of relationship, you were encouraged to domesticate and eventually granted visitation rights. If you were not in this kind of relationship, whether single or in another kind of committed relationship, government policy signalled that your intimate life was immaterial. As the writer Ben Weil argued during the pandemic, the UK government has heralded asceticism as the gold standard of public health, as opposed to condoning safer pandemic practices. COVID guidelines and legislation impacting people's relationships flew in the face of evidence from the AIDS crisis, which showed that disavowing sex outside of monogamous coupledom was not an effective strategy for sustainably reducing infection rates. Rather, writes Weil, insisting upon life-enhancing, community-building pleasure as vital was central to gay men's approach to developing the life-saving techniques we now understand as safer sex. The COVID-19 pandemic was harnessed as an opportunity to intensify what the writer Sophie Lewis has termed our collective turn-off. Erotophobia, she observes, runs deep both in the capitalist system and among its detractors. Boredom, or a lack of pleasure in our culture, are largely not acceptable reasons to end romantic relationships, nor to change their form. Indeed, if it disrupts our conformity to the way things are done, in work, in public, at home, in relationships, transforming any element of our lives because of erotic or spiritual stagnation is often frowned upon. The denial of pleasure to populations is a grave historic harm, writes Lewis, and the denial by some leftists of the centrality of pleasure to liberation struggles is a correspondingly serious error. If we are not finding pleasure in romantic coupledom, or indeed in our lives, the dominant cultural messaging holds work harder. There are whole industries in self-help, therapy, and advice-giving that profit from this ideal, generally exhorting heteronormative mores. The problem with this, argues Maura Weigel in Labour of Love, is not that we should expect relationships to be effortless, but that this relationship work falls mostly on women and individualises experiences and feelings that often reflect social forces. The work, too, is often directed towards ends that we don't, so we might discover if we dared, actually desire. The irony of the common sense approach to romantic love, that positions it as everyone's highest aspiration, is that it doesn't really believe in the power of love. Whilst love might be a creative and transformative force, the logic of romantic love just exhorts us to comply to pre-written rules.